Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, the 17th of June, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speakers are David Messenbring and Maria Jimenez. They will be continuing their series. Today is entitled, A Church in the Workplace, the Multicultural Mission of Maritime Ministry. Let's listen in.
My name is David Messenbring, and my wife Maria Jimenez. The two of us work together in maritime ministry, and the title of this session is called A Church in the Workplace, the Multicultural Mission of Maritime Ministry. And we're kind of excited, among the variety of things we do these 2 weeks, to share with you a little bit about the ministry that occupies us more than full-time in Port Everglades, Florida. And maybe we'll even get around to sharing with you how we're proud of having influenced the tradition. Let me begin by asking if any of you live near coasts or ports. Anybody here live in a port?
No.
Or nearby or on the coast?
Not anymore. I used to live in New York.
You used to live in New York City?
Well, yeah.
Uh-huh. Did you ever have contact with the
Siemens Institute?
Siemens Church Institute of New York and New Jersey?
Yeah.
Right. Which gave Maria her start, and I got started after I married her. Anybody else live near? Okay. Well, 95% of all international commerce travels by sea. And there are over a million people who leave home and live on ships, on board ships, to carry that cargo. In addition, there are over 100,000 people who live and work on cruise ships, which in the last 10 years become a big industry, especially in a place like South Florida where we are. In our port, we're trafficked by tens of thousands of people who work and live on the cargo ships and the cruise ships. 175 years ago in England, the Church of England began a ministry to seafarers. Their reasoning was that mission societies were working hard to gather the resources to send missionaries to convert lost heathen people in other parts of the world. And somebody in England said, why should we go all the way to Europe or Africa, Asia or Africa, when we've got such rough living, obviously lost persons right here in our ports? Seamen have traditionally had the image of being a pretty hard-living, rough crowd. So 175 years ago, the tradition of maritime ministry was born. Today, in about 800 ports worldwide, someone is listed as being responsible for maritime ministry by the International Christian Maritime Association. ICMA is the acronym, and they maintain a secretariat based in England, which coordinates internationally the work of maritime ministry. Not really coordinates it, facilitates a network. Port chaplains are traditionally very independently minded pastors, and those who can't get along elsewhere sometimes end up in the ports where they are a little freer to work with as they see fit. In the United States, there's an agency called NAMA, North American Maritime Ministry Association. And NAMA is the North American link to ICMA. International Christian Maritime Association is the global body, and North American Maritime Ministry Association is obviously the North American one. Canada and the U.S. About 180 agencies in North America are what NAMA claims, operating in ports. I was surprised when I learned that there were so many of these agencies. We have someone up here this week whose brother does port chaplaincy in Vancouver, Washington. And when she saw the article on the board, she was shocked. She said, I just always assumed that what Carl did in Vancouver was a one-time mission that somebody had once set up. She said, I had no idea that there were a string of these all over the place. And there are. We're independent, but they're there. Today, port chaplaincy is it varies tremendously. You still have people who are only concerned about saving souls and who go on board the ships and preach the gospel, and not any more than that. That's their focus. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have agencies that provide a full range of services that we'll describe a little bit later in the kind of style of evangelism that says you begin with what people's needs are and meet their basic needs, reflect a witness of love for the other, Christian moral love. And by doing that, by helping them meet their basic needs, then you enter into a relationship which is good news, and where you can also share other versions of the good news. So the tradition we're talking about, obviously from the perspective of one port where we work on it, is a very strong one throughout the ports of North America and the world. It has it's characterized by a unique set of five tenets. The first one I've already alluded to when I shared that maritime ministry is evangelical. It is a conscious effort to share the good news in the workplace. Most ministry as we think of it in our society is residentially oriented. You establish a congregation in a neighborhood where people live. And in a sense, maritime ministry is the same thing, except that people live where they work. Seafarers live on board ships where they work. And they don't have the option of going down the street to church on Sunday morning. Their best shot at church, their best shot really, is to establish a worshiping community on board. And Maria, who's our chaplain, works hard to provide printed and other audio and audiovisual resources to help people keep a faith life active while they're sailing. But when they're in port, we also try and provide a little ecumenical chapel where services take place. We can go on board the ships and pray with people, or actually hold a worship service if there's an interest in that. But in any event, it has to be a ministry in the workplace. And it's evangelical in the sense that we are there, called, sponsored by churches, to share the good news of God's love in Jesus Christ with seafarers. A third tenet is that it's ecumenical. Maritime ministry, not always, but best, is practiced ecumenically. Because if you're the population we see may be of any religion imaginable. When Maria talks about who the seafarers are in a few minutes, you'll start to get a sense of the tremendous multinational character of the people who work on ships today. And so tens of thousands of Muslims come into our center every year. And it's a little bit awkward to be trying to describe the difference between a Lutheran and an Episcopalian when you're face-to-face with a Muslim. It just doesn't make sense. The Christian-Protestant distinction is awkward. Maritime ministry is best practiced ecumenically. And in a number of ports around this country, it's done ecumenically very well. In Houston, for example, or in New York, or in Philadelphia, you have a broad ecumenical cooperation of many churches putting a chaplain in the same center. Sometimes the center itself is ecumenically owned. Sometimes, as in our case, it's an independent nonprofit organization with board of directors that represent different church bodies, as well as the unions, as well as the industry. That's kind of our board. In some ports, one church body owns the mission and invites others to work out of it. In Jacksonville, Florida, there's a marvelous cooperation. In a Lutheran started, but Lutherans gave up on it and aren't involved anymore, Southern Baptist operated mission that a Franciscan Catholic deacon works out. So if you can imagine the Southern Baptists and the Roman Catholics happily working together in a common witness of God's love. It happens, and it happens best when it's done ecumenically. Maritime ministry is the most multicultural ministry in the church, at least in the North American church. I'm convinced of that. People come to us from the whole world. More seafarers come from the Philippines than any other single country. For several months last winter, the largest, I read the phone bill. I do the administration, and I read the phone bill. Because as you'll hear, we help people make lots of phone calls. Over 9,000 a month right now, we're averaging. And for a while, Indonesia was the most popularly called, the largest numbers of calls. More calls went to Indonesia than any other country during the first few months of this year. Central and South America, Eastern Europe now, Croatia, Yugoslavia, Russia, Poland, Hungary. The multicultural, multi-faith, multilinguistic, and of course multinational. But virtually all port chaplains are familiar with this tenet of maritime ministry. And then finally, the theme that will be the focus of our session tomorrow morning, maritime ministry is a justice ministry. Seafarers these days, as a result of the decline in port state flags and the increasing popularity of flags of convenience, what that means is that a ship owner, an American ship owner, for example, used to fly the U.S. flag and very rarely does anymore. Now registers his or her ship in Liberia or Panama or Honduras or Belize or one of a number of other countries that sell flags of convenience so that the U.S. ship owner can avoid tax laws and labor laws. And as soon as their flag is officially registered in Panama, they can go to the Philippines and recruit people to work on board for $250 a month at 100 hours a week. We literally see people. That's the low end of the scale. Actually, the low end of the scale are people who don't get paid at all. And that's where the justice ministry comes in. Port chaplains are usually the first and often the only land-based people who come to know about abuses of human and civil rights that take place and that happen to seafarers, because those ships are like little floating dictatorships of a captain, and you put a racist Greek or German captain on board with a Filipino crew, and sometimes bad things happen. Which is why port chaplains need to be there in port, going out on board, visiting the ships, welcoming people to port, and saying, how are things? And as Maria can tell you, sometimes the fifth or sixth time you ask that question, how are things, somebody kind of whispers and says, come over here. And then, or maybe they won't say anything while you're on board, but they'll come and visit us in the center later and take us aside and tell us stories that that are chilling and that we will focus on tomorrow morning in a session called Law or Gospel, the Church and Seafarers' Rights. Should port chaplains get involved with questions of human rights? That's a little bit of an overview on the breadth of how it's practiced throughout the world and some of the major tenets. And I'm going to turn it over to Maria at this point, who founded our ministry and before she met and married me. And 5 years ago, we went back and developed it, and we'll tell you a little bit this morning about what has come of that.
First of all, if you have any questions as I speak, feel free to interrupt. I like the dialogue. But anyway, we call seafarers is a term to include women. There are also women at sea working, and we thought that seamen or sailors was a little bit rude towards their gender. So that's why we call Seafarers Ministry, and our facility is called Seafarers House. The seafarers that come to our port are those who live and work on cargo ships and cruise ships. The difference between these two is cruise ships are about 500, an average of 500 on a single ship, while in the cargo ship there might be 20, 22 or so. But I'm going to speak a little bit how do seafarers live on cruise ships. David said a little bit about the myth on who the seafarers are. Traditionally, we thought seafarers were womanizers, heavy drinkers, and unreliable people that it's better not to be close to. But today, this image has changed quite a deal, since most of them are forced to come to work on a ship because that's the best they can do, is the source of income. The jobs at home are very few, non-existent. That's why we see men and women from developing countries, especially Philippines, Central and South America. Now we see a lot of from Eastern Europe, Poland, and as you were saying, Yugoslavia and Croatia, lots of Croatian, Russian. These men and women are highly trained and they're still very cheap, so they can work for very little money, maybe $400, $500 a month, and it's a good deal for the ship owners. On the cruise ships, what I hear is a lot of concern about the amount of hours they work. It's normal to expect a crew member work 12 hours, a shift of 12 hours, 14 hours a day without a day off. That means for a year contract that they have to be on the ship, living and working on the same ship. So that goes on every day.
Same waiter serves breakfast, lunch, dinner, and midnight buffet.
Yes. And below deck, you might find the dishwasher who, one of the good things about holding is that it exposes you to tough jobs like the dish team. And I was thinking as I was cleaning pots and the noise and the hecticness, how do the dishwash people at the ships, at the cruise ships that serve food for 900 or even more, 2,000 passengers every day? What does it feel to? I mean, I was really being concerned. And we can see these men who really show up at our center with their hands all broken up, and they look very tired. They sleep very little, and that is causing some accidents, maybe a strain in the back. They have problems with raising so much weight. So as soon as something comes up, they're taken to the doctor on board, who is mainly there to serve the passengers. But when they see that a crew member is having serious problems, they just send them home. And it's very sad that most of the times we don't reach them before they go home, and they end up arriving in their homes sick and unable to feed their families, to support their families anymore. Every time they come to work, they have a medical exam to be sure that this person is okay, but he might go back home, end up with an hernia or a back problem. So it's important for them to have a center where they can express their needs and get help if you know, back problem is a common thing. It happens, but they might also be working intensively with the cleaning harsh chemicals, and they might, as the result, they might have problems in the nose or in the eyes, ears. So the company is gonna try to get rid of him as soon as possible, because he's a person that is no longer useful for them. And maybe in the next port in Costa Rica or Cancun or one of those countries that they don't have a place to go, the crew members, they send them home. So it's very, very sad. Sometimes we have collect calls from Guatemalans or Filipinos at home that they need to see a doctor back home, and we have to find a lawyer who might represent them in a U.S. Court and fight for the seafarers' rights to be entitled for medical health. But we'll see this theme a little bit more tomorrow. So as the result of the intense labor and lack of communication with one another, they just work like machines. They do the work, boom, 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 12 hours a day, every day. So they end up feeling very alienated, very lonely, without the support of the family. These persons are used to live in a with great support of the families. Families are extended, and they all live together, but they end up very isolated. So they come to Sivir's house with great need for listening, for being heard, for being treated as human beings, not just as objects. We smile a lot because often we don't have the words, but just by being kind and accompanying them to different places, they just by being with them, they feel very good. We orient them into the community. We let them know where places are, where not to go, where to go. It's if you ever go or travel abroad, you feel a little bit vulnerable, and you might feel that someone is trying to get advantage of you, sell you things more expensive, or how to take a taxi, or how to move around. So we try to do a good job in that. So this is a little bit of, life on the cruise ship. It's also very agitated. Imagine, it's a little bit like, not like home, but they must see people coming and going all the time, passengers, and for a week, this might be a week cruise or 3-4 days cruise, or maybe a month, but they interact with passengers who are there to be served, with passengers that don't always understand their language, and they start ridiculizing their accent, or they're making fun of them because they're not quick enough or smart enough. So these waiters or busboys or cleaners, what kind of image of Americans do you have? Yes.
Can you say a little bit about the difference between men and women, and what the women do and what their typical problems are?
Thank you. Women are waitress and cleaners. They help in the cabins. Women do have a hard time. I have met women who have been sexually harassed by officers, and if they don't consent, they will be sent home. and the pressure of being sent home, because most of them have children and long families to support, they have to agree to have sex. And that's very hard. The other sexual harassment problem that I see is that they ask them to wear very short skirts, even if they don't want, that's the uniform. And that's very annoying. They see how people go there and drink and gamble and then they eat and then... So for them, I think it must be a crazy situation how people live with so much and they have so little. So it's...
Imagine someone coming from rural Guatemala with traditional rural values of who's worked very hard to support a family, has to leave that family behind, and you come and you get on a cruise ship and you see our culture at its most obscene.
Yeah.
What do you think about the fairness of the world?
And I would imagine that people on the cruise ship would treat those women as though they were property or part of the deal in the cruise, and be of invade their space and privacy.
Exactly. I remember this woman from England. She was in the beauty salon. She was a hairdresser. That's also position, or in the sauna, whatever they have this. And the captain said, "Oh, I want you to come upstairs and cut my hair in my cabin." And she said, "No, you come down like everybody else." And then they accused her of having drugs.
Well, then the other issue was she was a white English woman, and she had been dating Jamaicans. And the announcement was made that white women were not to date...
Yes, black people.
Black people, and she continued to do it. So then they accused her of... they put her off the ship and accused her of having drugs.
Or using drugs. So she took the test and then was proved that she didn't.
Well, but you underestimate your role. She worked in Tampa. She came to Miami on her way home to England very frustrated, and someone in Miami told her about Maria. She called Maria. Maria arranged for her to get a drug test, because her main issue at that point was to clear her name. She had no interest in going back to the ship, but she didn't want it on her permanent work record that she had been dismissed for doing drugs. And at Maria's suggestion, she got a drug test, which showed she was clean, and then she went home to England with at least her name clear.
Some cruise ships do have a lot of nationalities, so they, if there is some time unhappiness, they would remain calm. I mean, that by usually when you have different nationalities, there are some rivalries among one country and another. Except one line that uses 90% Asian crew, and they're all from Indonesia and the Philippines. It's a different feeling. Well, maybe, yes. I can think that Asian people tend to be more docile in a way, and they're easy to control. As for Latins and maybe Europeans, they spend their energies fighting one another, and then they won't create problems with the administration.
So the cruise ships are... They have these button flags from other countries so that they can avoid the American labor laws.
Right.
But they advertise in the U.S. like they're being run by American companies. I mean, I never...
The Merchant Marine. Yeah, how does that work out with the Merchant Marine?
We'll get to cargo in a minute. Yeah.
But they always say when they make the advertising is Bahamas Registry, Panama Registry.
Okay.
They tell you what is the flag of the vessel.
Okay. And that's how they avoid the American labor laws, and that they can...
And tax laws.
and tax loss.
The two most successful, the two currently most profitable cruise companies in the United States are actually sister companies of the same. Carnival Cruise Line, and based in Miami, and Holland America, based in Seattle. They're sisters of the same thing. The owner, actually it's a public company, but the one with the biggest share of ownership in the company is Mickey Arison, who, born and raised in the United States, but transferred his citizenship to Israel because of the tax advantages for him of doing so. No, I mean, he's a prominent local citizen in Miami. He owns the Miami Heat basketball team.
But he's an Israeli citizen.
He's an Israeli citizen.
And do his ships fly with Israeli flags?
Carnival and Holland America, what flag do they ship?
Panama.
And I've never cruised, but it's my understanding from reading that, you know, you leave tips. That's the license that isn't covered. Do they actually get the tip money then?
Yes, they do share the tip money.
And those who interface with the passengers.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And that's what they earn. Otherwise, it's $50 a month, their salary, and the rest is on tips. But the tips is tricky because you have to beg for the trip, for the tip. You have to smile a lot and you have to earn your salary by being nice.
And the people who are in a position to interface with the passengers and collect the tips, if you're working in the hotel or in the dining room, for example, those are the envied positions. If you're in the engine room and you never interface with the passengers, you probably make less money.
Yeah, that's a fixed salary. That is, it might differ from the chief engineer to the oiler or the wiper who might get $300 a month, but it's still another...
There's a question back here.
Perhaps you covered this and I didn't hear it. Who funds this service, this ministry, the seafarers?
Can you hold that question a little bit? Well, when we get to... it's a good question. But
do they have any unions or anything?
There is a union, it's called International Transport Workers Federation, that is the international agency that supports the workers of the transport. It's called IATF, and they have inspectors around the country and around the world, but they do limited work. Especially they do help on cases where there is a strike, and there are negotiations with contracts with, they can touch those cruise ships. They, as soon as the company learns there is an idea or there is an initiative of organizing, everybody will be automatically fired.
They just change the crew totally.
And then we'll send the names to other ships that these people can never get a job again in their life. It's called blacklist.
The ITF is very unusual for a union in that it doesn't just serve its membership. The ITF took a decision a few years ago, International Transport Workers Federation, that if they were only going to serve their membership, they would be rendered largely irrelevant because so few ships are registered as ITF ships. So the ITF has a very broad vision and tries to serve the seafaring workforce in general, even though most of them don't work. But of course, they have more authority to work on an ITF registered ship than they do on one that isn't. And I think is it safe to say that virtually none of the cruise ships are ITF registered?
No.
Some of the cargo ships are. But the ITF is there. To answer your question ahead of schedule a little bit, they are a major funder of capital improvements to maritime ministries. When we put up our building, which is actually six trailers kind of configured together, they made a $225,000 grant to that building. They buy a lot of vans for port chaplains because they've come to realize that port chaplains are often the only person, the only group in a port that's really taking care of the seafarers. So they have a wealthy trust fund in England and they make grants to support us. No operating money, you know, they won't pay salaries or your daily budget kind of stuff. But if you need to buy a van or put up a building, they'll help. Should we do cargo?
it blows me away that all these people are working in the ships and that this is such an unknown thing. I mean, that it's really hidden. It's hidden very well.
We say that seafarers are one of two groups of invisible laborers in our society that we all depend on every day and hardly ever think about. The other one being the farm workers. And in recent years, we've been sensitized to at least be aware that there are farm workers out there who are migrant workers from other societies, other countries, who put the food on our table. Until I met and married Maria, it never dawned on me.
Yeah.
And my cousin teaches cultural anthropology in New Orleans at a Lutheran high school. She struggles year in and year out to find ways of helping her students just get exposed to the idea that there are different cultures. And what is a different culture? She said, until we met her in March at a Gulf Coast Port Chaplains conference and stayed with her, she said, it never dawned on me, and I'm somebody looking for access to different cultures. I never thought of looking in the port.
One reason that is hidden, the seafarers work under a lot of supervision. They have three or four bosses, each one of them, and they are constantly looked upon. And if they talk with passengers, they have a fine. Mm-hmm. They have a fine.
It won't promote the cruise industry.
Yes.
For passengers to know what working conditions are like.
No. No.
Maria, I'm interested to know how this became visible to you when you started to do this work.
I first began hearing the stories of the cargo ships. And then when the Seamen's Church Institute asked me if I could do work, maritime ministry in Florida, I didn't know what was the situation like on the cruise ships. And as I came to Miami and didn't have a facility to operate from, my work was out of a van, go to the terminals and meet the people there, like in the market. I would just ask them, let them know who I am, and just to hear from them what do they do and who are they, where do they come from. And there is where I learned the details of their lives at the ship, and how life is, how hard it is, and how unfair and just, and how they should deserve a just salary for what they do. But then they said the reply of the owners say, well, you should be thankful to us because we are providing you with a job, otherwise that you would be hungry in your own country. At least you should be happy and recognize that we are giving you an opportunity.
Well, and the cost of cruises have gone down significantly, haven't they, like in the last 10 to 15 years? Mm-hmm. So is that, they're just not passing, they're not increasing any wages or doing anything to improve?
No, I don't think so. I don't know what, it's very complex, the financing of all these cruise ships, and how, I don't get that.
Ships have gotten bigger, so the economy of scale makes it cheaper in many cases to cruise now than 15 years ago. Today, every year there are new ships. We just had the world's largest cruise ship was christened in our port in December, the Sun Princess, which holds, I think, 2,200 passengers and carries a crew of 900.
But some might say that they get more money on the cruise ship than they get in Guatemala.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And we're caught in the middle, because on the one hand, it looks like an outrageous exploitation of people, but on the other hand, we work closely enough with the crew members to know that this is the best job they can get. For several reasons, not the least of which is that they're paid in U.S. cash. And if you're a Honduran or a Filipino, the currency in your country is losing value constantly. And if you're paid in U.S. dollars and transfer that into to your local currency, it always buys the same amount of bread, even though other jobs in Honduras, the value of that wage is slowly declining. Yours holds its value. We've met doctors, people medically trained, people, graduates of medical school from Colombia, for whom this is the best job they can get, working on a cruise ship for a few years.
Teachers.
Save some money, get some capital. But one of the problems is that the life on board is so alienating and depressing that we see in many cases it takes a very strong person to hold your discipline and actually save that money and go back home and start a business and not have to come back to CPAC. Mm-hmm. The weaker people start drinking, and then you spend all your money drinking or making phone calls home.
Or they buy these electronics, videos, and expensive things that once they're back home are useless or they're broken, and it's not very interesting investment. So they, that's interesting. So the other part is the cargo ships, the merchant marines. The ship may vary. They usually vary from one to another in terms of you can see a rich house or a poor house. It's very striking on a given day to go ship visiting and be on a ship that is clean and with good food, and it has a kitchen self-service and all. The officers and crew, they eat in the same table. Then you go to another ship and it barely has clean water or sheets or linens, or it's so dirty. So it changes. Then again, officers from Europe countries, they're better paid, they have positions of authority, while the poor countries, they serve in lower ranks. Their contracts also change. A German captain might work 4 months only and then go home another 4 months for vacation, while the Filipino or the Guatemalan have to work for a year.
In our newsletter, which we publish monthly, there's a story from Maria in the current one back there about a man she met on board who was staying on board for three successive one-year contracts in order to earn enough money to be able to build a house. 3 years on board the ship without going home and seeing his family.
Well, we have to say that it was his choice.
Yep.
That company offered the possibility to remain on the ship as long as he wants. And because he wants to build a house, he decides to spend 3 years of his life on the ship without going home. That's not very wise, but it's his freedom to choose that option.
Mm-hmm.
The problems that the merchant marine face are, again, safety, medical, psychological, loneliness. The ship is an area that is very rigid. It has a very hierarchical structure, and the chief mate or the captain does not talk about his private business with the cook. There is like being in an office for a year. And so they don't show to each other their vulnerabilities, and they pretend that everyone is very secure and important in their position. So when they come to Zipper's house, again, they want to open up and talk about their families and their problems and their hopes, and they want to see around. The challenge that we now face is the industry is moving faster and faster. Last years they had a few days in port to sightsee and do some shopping. Now, in matters of hours, the ship is ready to sail. So the crews don't have no time to visit. And that's a problem because they are begin always locked up there in on the ship. And so we think that one of the roles of the church is to minister their needs at where they live and where they work, and that's on the vessel, that's on the ship. And we Seafarer's House goes on the ship visitors go on and identify the needs and the situations, what can we do for them, just by being present, being there for them. It's a ministry of hospitality to wish them welcome and see what.
We'll have a few minutes left. Let's talk about some of the services that we provide.
Well, you mentioned some. Did you talk about communications, the phone bills, and
not much.
Not much. We have 42 booths at the center.
Phone booths.
They can talk forever, as much as 2 hours, as little as 5 minutes. They love to talk with their children and wives, and it's number one need.
We have placed on a busy day with a lot of cruise ships in port. We have placed as many as 1,000 phone calls in one day.
And the sailors pay, the seafarers pay for them?
This goes back to your question about who funds it. Churches provide some funding, but in those centers which are 100, 150, 175 years old, it's been in the church, local church budget forever, and it's a sacred line in the budget. If you know much about funding for social service ministries today, it's very tough to start a new ministry. And when Marie arrived in our port in 89, there was nothing. So these are difficult times to get funding from the churches to start a new ministry. They're having a hard time keeping the doors open on their old ministries. So in our case, in order to bring maritime ministry to South Florida, we had to be creative and find some new sources. And the telephone calls are one. Because we do those phones in such high volume, and the seafarers pay for those calls, we can offer them a call cheaper than they can get anywhere else and still earn some of the money we need to pay for our electricity and our staff costs. The port supports us also.
Another service is money remittance. Migrant workers, as you know, they rely on sending money home so their families can survive. And they trust us so much that they give us their money, and we, with the help of an agency, we send it to their families in 1 or 2 days. The money is there.
We wire transfer to 28 countries and sell huge volumes of money orders where the post office is secure enough that people can buy a money order and send it home.
We have chapel services, counseling services, and we have English classes.
For ESL those. Classes, English is second.
Yes, English.
Postage, we sold $17,500 worth of stamps last year. And that's a simple thing, but when you think about it, we think of it as a great way to share God's love. That's a lot of love that goes from lonely seafarers back home to their families. They'll get on one of our 42 phone booths or 6 cordless phones, because we don't let them smoke in the center. So if they want to smoke, they take a cordless phone outside on the deck and smoke. From those 48 lines, they'll after they pay for their call, right there on the wall is a big rack of greeting cards. And we sell a huge volume of greeting cards, dirt cheap, $1 for a greeting card. And you can pick out a card and write a happy birthday note to your 5-year-old daughter right there at the counter, and then give it to us. We put the stamp on it and we'll mail it for them that night. It's a simple thing, but if you're living and working on a ship, and you've got so little time ashore, and you have no idea where the post office is, let alone where the drugstore is to buy a greeting card, and you don't have the time to go to those different places, it really is a ministry to be able to come into our spot and deal with all those things at once.
How many on your staff?
We're over 20 employees now. When we started 5 years ago next month, and we shared one full-time position between us. and one full-time salary. We actually both worked full-time. We got one salary. And now we have over 20 employees, 22, 23, something like that, about nine of which are full-time and the rest are hourly. Plus, we depend heavily on volunteers, and we'd like to invite any of you who want a warm place to go in the wintertime to come down and volunteer. We have a Canadian couple that comes for 4 to 6 weeks every winter, and they just love us, and we love them. And this year, because we even helped them with their housing, we knew that their needs were very modest, and we found a cheap trailer for them to rent nearby for a
month. Where is it? What city?
Fort Lauderdale's port. Nice place, lovely part of the country. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, I skipped out, and I'll ask this question anyway. You might have talked about it. Do I hear that there's no opportunity for them to have any coverage by, does their ship line cover them in any way for their medical?
You know, let's...
Did anyone ask that question?
We're going to do a whole session on that tomorrow.
Okay.
Seafarers' rights. The ship line is supposed to, just quickly, the company's supposed to cover them, but sometimes doesn't.
I'll be here tomorrow.
Good, and you'll get the full story tomorrow.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Other services that...
Well, what kind of sleeping arrangement do they have on board?
It varies from ship to ship. The new ships are pretty good. They usually share the cabin with two. But the old ones, there were as much as six. Mm-hmm. Six men in a cabin. And they have different shifts. So when one goes to bed, the other gets up. One smokes, the other doesn't. One drinks, the other. So it's very stressful. Never rest.
Right, and in your personal space, I'm just talking from experience. Also, in Astoria, Oregon, we had a Mariner Center that I explained to them, and I went on board one ship, and there were eight guys, and they were all hovering around me in this little space, you know. And I brought them some things on board, and I didn't realize there was a guy sleeping right behind me under a blanket. It was a Taiwanese ship, and this guy is just a tiny little man, and I didn't realize till they said something to him and he came out of the blanket. I was like, oh my word, and here I am sitting on the bed, half of his bed, not even knowing he existed yet, because he was that shoved up against the wall. And they were just amazing. They were like, wow. So it's real compact and sometimes very uncolorful, especially the Russian floating processors. They look like gulags. Not a stroke of paint anywhere, just rust.
A couple of other services I want to highlight. Maria works hard to have religious literature in various languages available. And you'd be amazed the huge volume of daily devotionals that we go through in a couple of different languages. And you know that those are being used because people come back at the end of the three-month cycle. You know, they usually come in quarterly books. And they'll say, I've only got another week left. Have you got the next quarter's book here in English or in Spanish? That's a great service that we provide. Bibles in 18 or 20 different languages. I've lost count. We go through huge numbers of Bibles. Maria does a terrific job of counseling on a wide variety of themes, from alcoholism, which is a big problem, to... reunion issues. She's very good at finding people who are about to go home or people that have just come from home and helping them process the difficulty. You know, maybe before you went away, you were the head of the household in a Latin American society, for example. And now you've been away for a year and you're about to go back home and there are big changes that have taken place there, although in your own mind, that home is still the way it was before you left it. And Maria's got good literature and good facility for the amount of counseling that we do is on a wide variety of subjects is tremendous. I've seen two people get on our phones and learn at different times and learn that a parent had just died. You know, we care that at that moment somebody who has that news should fall into loving hands.
But that counseling is not just from me, is from all the staff, is from every person that happens to be there, because, you know, listening is pretty not easy, but it can be done with love.
And a real strength, I think, of our ministry compared with most of them, this is where we're a little bit different, is that usually, you know, if your funding is, most poor chaplaincies, the funding is a little bit more secure. It's been in the budget forever. And so the pastor kind of goes and does what he or she can in the poor with the time that they have. We took the point of view that our call was to empower the ministry, that our call was to serve the needs of tens of thousands of people who are coming through there every month. And there was no way we were going to be able to do that ourselves. So we really see our ministry as empowering the ministry of these other people. And every one of our 20-some employees is told when they start, you're a minister.
And volunteers.
And our volunteers, thank you. We've got over 50 people who volunteer, local people for the most part, who volunteer on a regular basis. And we tell them, you are a minister here. And we really see our ministry as empowering the ministry of the others that work there. Some people, you know, criticize me, say I should do more. Some of my fellow poor chaplains tell me that I should be, because I'm an ordained pastor, I should be going on board the ships more and leading the worship service. And I tell them that we are ministering to a lot more people because I use my gifts for administration to facilitate an agency that has 20 employees and 50 volunteers who are open now 106 hours a week. That's an average of over 15 hours a day, every day of the year. And when cargo ships sail in and out at any given hour of any given day so quickly, it's a ministry just to have the doors open that much of the time. If we were doing the ministry ourselves, I can promise you it'd be limited to, you know, 12 or 14 hours a day at the most. I want to say, in closing, we got 5 minutes left, I want to say a word about what the seafarers offer us, particularly in light of the Bible study theme this week about exiles and aliens. Our board is very clear now that a big chunk of our ministry is to serve the needs of the seafarers. But we also, and the reason we personally do the work, is that we see the seafarers as having a tremendous ministry to us. When I go and preach in the local churches, I talk about how our baptism calls us to life in a community that is complete. And then remind ourselves that at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, we experience the most segregated, racially segregated hour in America. And how can that be? And that we're called to be part of a community that is multicultural, multinational, multilinguistic. And say, if you don't have a good way of working on that, come and volunteer with us because we can offer you a good experience. And middle class white people come in who don't really ever get much contact with black people, and start placing those phone calls or just tending the cash register or being around the center and get to know Jamaicans and discover how charming these Jamaicans are. Or I like to tell the story of Dahlia, a middle-class woman who had her own real estate business, very successful, and in South Florida where there are huge numbers of Spanish-speaking people and Spanish is rapidly becoming the dominant language. There are some confirmed monolinguists, people who are determined never to speak anything but English, because this, after all, is the United States. And Dolly was one such person, but she came and started volunteering for us, and after about 6 months said to me one day, you know, working here makes me want to learn a little Spanish. And I said, well, praise God, that's also part of our ministry, to broaden the worldview of people. At an affair recently at the University of Miami Law School, they do a regatta once a year to benefit us. And after this day of partying, there are some, you know, law students, middle class white law students, drinking a few beers and feeling pretty good. And I started talking with one of them, and this woman said to me, oh, they leave home a year at a time? I would never marry a man like that. I would never marry a man who's going to... And I wanted to share with her, I said, you come and volunteer with us and get to know these people and discover how most of the world's people just don't have the choices that we have and how we spend our time. You work with these Hondurans and Guatemalans and Filipinos and Indonesians, and you begin to look on our society a lot differently. For example, I think one of the most frequently made comments to me by the volunteers is, you know, these guys come in here, and men and women come in here and make their phone calls, and it would be so easy for them to leave without paying. They could cheat you so easily, and they don't. And I say, yeah, and that's part of why we want you to come here and get to know the people of the world, because not all societies have degenerated in ways that ours has. I mean, not that our mission is to teach what a bad society we have, because that is far from the case. You also really get to realize how fortunate we are. I'm reading this week some novels from Indonesia, because we work with huge numbers of Indonesians, and I'm shocked to discover that this novelist is banned today and under house arrest in Jakarta. And we start thinking about, well, should we sell those books in our centers? So the multi-faith experience, the exposure to people's basic moral integrity, their love for their family, who they can't be with, the degree, you know, the fervent way in which they read those daily devotionals and care about it, their piety, their Christian piety, the worldview they offer us. That's also one of the great gifts of maritime ministry to the whole church, and why this session has been called A Church in the Workplace, The Multicultural Mission of Maritime Ministry. Thank you for joining us.